Aidid's revolutionary forces. Barre had been overthrown in 1991, but the Habergidia had been unable to consolidate political power. Now, the same Boutros Ghali, through the UN, was again trying to defeat them. This is how they saw it. So they were living as they had for many years, hiding from those in power, biding time, and looking for chances to strike. That day in July, the leadership had gathered to discuss how to respond to a peace initiative from Jonathan Howe, the retired American admiral who was then leading the UN mission in Mogadishu. Men of middle age were seated at the center of the room on rugs. Elders took chairs and sofas that had been arranged around the perimeter. Among the elders present were religious leaders, former judges, professors, the poet Mo'alim Soyan, and the clan's most senior leader, Sheikh Haji Mohammed Iman Eden, who was over 90 years old. Behind the elders, standing against the walls, were the youngest men. Many of those present wore Western clothing, shirts and pants, but most wore the colorful traditional Somali wraparound cotton skirts called ma'awis. They were the best-educated members of the clan. Ever since the collapse of order and government in Somalia, there was little work for intellectuals. So a meeting like this was a big event, a chance to argue over the direction of things. Aidid himself was not present. In the weeks since the UN searched and leveled most of the buildings in his residential compound, he had been in hiding. Gebdid and some of the others present were his close advisers, hardliners, men with blood on their hands. Some were responsible for attacks on UN troops, including the massacre of the Pakistanis. There were also moderates in the crowd, men who saw themselves as realists. Ruling impoverished Somalia meant little without friendly ties with the larger world. The Habergidir were enthusiastic capitalists. Many of the men in this room were businessmen, eager to resume the flood of international aid and trading ties with America and European powers. They were troubled by the obstructionist and increasingly dangerous game Aidid was playing with the UN. In Mogadishu's present atmosphere of confrontation, their arguments were unlikely to prevail, but some in the crowd at Abdi House were there to argue for peace. Farah was one of the moderates, a garrulous, balding man in his 30s. He was eager for some kind of normalcy in his country, and for friendly ties with nations that could help Somalia. Farah was an engineer, educated in part in Germany. He saw opportunity in the terrible ruins of Mogadishu. Before him lay a lifetime of important and lucrative rebuilding. But he also believed the man who deserved to lead the country, and the only one who would steer valuable engineering contracts his way, was his clansman, Aidid. The UN wanted to treat all the warlords and clans as equals, when they were not equal. Farah was on the perimeter of the room with the younger men, but instead of standing, he had set himself down on one knee between two sofas, which probably saved his life. The TOW missile is designed to penetrate the armored hull of a tank. It is a two-stage, 40-pound projectile with fins at the middle and back that trails a copper wire as thin as a human hair. The wire allows the TOW to be steered in flight so that it will follow precisely the path of a targeting laser. Equipped with a shaped charge inside its rounded tip, on impact it spurts a jet of plasma, molten copper, which burns through the outer layer of its target, allowing the missile to penetrate and deliver its full explosive charge within. The explosion is powerful enough to dismember anyone standing near it and hurls deadly sharp metal fragments in all directions. What Farah saw and heard was a flash of light and a violent crack. He stood and took one step forward and heard the whoosh of a second missile. There was another flash and explosion. He was thrown to the floor. Thick smoke filled the room. He tried to move forward, but his way was blocked by bodies, a bloody pile of men and parts of men, a meter high. Among those killed instantly was the eldest, Sheikh Haji Iman. Through the smoke, Pharaoh was startled to see Gebdeed bloody and burned, but still standing at the center of the carnage. At another part of the room, Abdullahi Osoble Barre was momentarily dazed by the blasts. To him, it looked like the men closest to the flash had just evaporated. As soon as he recovered his wits, he began looking for his son. Those who had survived the first blast were feeling along the wall, groping for the door, when the second missile exploded. The air was thick with dark smoke and smelled of powder, blood, and burned flesh. Farah found the stairs, stood, and had taken one step down when a third missile exploded, disintegrating the staircase. He tumbled to the first floor. He sat up, stunned, and felt himself for broken bones and wet spots. He saw he was bleeding from a thick gash in his right forearm. He felt a burning there and on his back, which had been punctured in several places with shrapnel. He crawled forward. There was another explosion above him, then another, and another. 16 missiles were fired in all. Still trapped upstairs, Barre found his son alive beneath a pile of mangled bodies. He began pulling men off, and parts of their bodies came off in his hands. After a great struggle, he managed to free his son, who was semi-conscious, jerking him free by the legs. Then they heard the Americans from the helicopters storming the house. So he and his son lay still among the bleeding and played dead. Farah crawled until he found a door to the outside. He saw one of his clansmen running from the house. And in the sky, he saw the helicopters, cobras mostly, but also some Blackhawks. The sky was full of them. Red streams poured from the cobras' miniguns. The men with Farah in the doorway had a quick decision to make. Some had blood running from their mouths and ears. They could stay in the burning house or brave the helicopter's guns outside. "Let's go out together," one of the men said. "Some of us will live, and some will die." His wounds had nearly healed in the 3 months since. Now, as the armada of American helicopters roared overhead, he was reminded of the shock, pain, and terror. The sight filled him and his friends with rage. It was one thing for the world to intervene to feed the starving, and even for the UN to help Somalia form a peaceful government. But this business of sending U.S. Rangers swooping down into their city, killing and kidnapping their leaders, this was too much. Bashir Haji Yusuf heard the helicopters as he relaxed with friends at his house, chewing kat and embroiled in fadika dirir, the traditional Somali afternoon hours of male discussion and argument and laughter. Today, they had been talking about the situation, which is about all they ever discussed anymore. With no government, no courts, no law, and no university, there was no work for lawyers in Mogadishu, but Yusuf never wanted for argument. They all stepped out to see. Yusuf, too, saw the legs dangling and knew it was the Rangers. They all despised the Rangers and the Blackhawks, which seemed now to be over the city continually. They flew in groups at all hours of day and night, swooping down so low they destroyed whole neighborhoods, blew down market stalls, and terrorized cattle. Women walking the streets would have their colorful robes blown off. Some had infants torn from their arms by the powerful updraft. On one raid, a mother screamed frantically in flex cuffs for nearly a half hour before a translator arrived to listen and to explain that her infant had been blown down the road by the landing helicopters. The residents complained that pilots would deliberately hover over their roofless outdoor showers and toilets. Blackhawks would flare down on busy traffic circles, creating havoc, then power off, leaving the crowd below choking on dust and exhaust. Mogadishu felt brutalized and harassed. Yusuf was disappointed in the Americans. He had been partly educated in the United States and had many friends there. What troubled him most was he knew they meant well. He knew his friends back in South Carolina, where he had attended the university, saw this mission to Somalia as an effort to end starving and bloodshed. They never saw what their soldiers were actually doing here in the city. How could these bloody ranger raids alter things? The situation was as old and as complicated as his life. Civil war had destroyed all semblance of the old order of things. In this new chaotic Somalia, the shifting alliances and feuds of the clans and sub-clans were like the patterns wind carved in the sand. Often, Yusuf himself didn't understand what was going on. And yet, these Americans, with their helicopters and laser-guided weapons and shock troop rangers, were going to somehow sort it out in a few weeks, arrest Idid, and make it all better. They were trying to take down a clan, the most ancient and efficient social organization known to man. Didn't the Americans realize that for every leader they arrested, there were dozens of brothers, cousins, sons, and nephews to take his place? Setbacks just strengthened the clan's resolve. Even if the Habergidir were somehow crippled or destroyed, wouldn't that just elevate the next most powerful clan? Or did the Americans expect Somalia to suddenly sprout full-fledged Jeffersonian democracy? Yusuf knew the bile on Idid's radio station was nonsense, about how the UN and the Americans had come to colonize Somalia and wanted to burn the Quran. But in the months since the Abdi House attack, he had come to share the popular anger toward American forces. On September 19th, after a bulldozer crew of engineers from the 10th Mountain Division was attacked by a band of Somalis, Cobra helicopters attached to the QRF launched tow missiles and cannon fire into the crowd that came to see the shooting, killing nearly 100 people. The helicopters had become an evil presence over the city. Yusuf remembered lying in bed one night with his wife, who was pregnant, when Blackhawks had come. One hovered directly over their house. The walls shook, and the noise was deafening, and he was afraid his roof, like others in the village, would be sucked off. In the racket, his wife reached over and placed his hand on her belly. "Can you feel it?" she asked. He felt his son kicking in her womb, as if thrashing with fright. As a lawyer who spoke fluent English, Yusuf had led a group of his villagers to the UN compound to complain. They were told nothing could be done about the rangers. They were not under UN command. Soon, every death associated with the fighting was blamed on the rangers. Somalis joked bitterly that the United States had come to feed them just to fatten them up for slaughter. Yusuf saw the armada slow about 2 kilometers away to the north, over by the Bakara market. If they were going into Bakara, there would be big trouble. The helicopters circled around the Olympic Hotel. Right away, he heard the shooting start. Chapter 2 Most of the rangers saw Super 6-1 going down. Chalk 2's saw gunner, Specialist John Waddell, had started to relax, more or less, on the northeast corner. He could hear the pop of gunfire at the other chalk locations around the target block. But after 60 gunner Nelson had cut down that crowd of Somalis, things had quieted at their position. Waddell heard Lieutenant Di Tommaso say over the radio that they were getting ready to move to the vehicles, which meant the D-boys must be finished in the target house. He'd be back at the hangar with an hour or two of sunlight left, enough time for him to find a sunny spot on top of a Konex and finish that Grisham novel. Then there was an explosion overhead. Waddell looked up to see a Blackhawk twisting oddly as it flew. "Hey, that bird's going down," shouted one of the men across the street. Nelson screamed, "A bird's been hit! A bird's been hit!" Nelson had seen the whole thing. He had seen the flash of the RPG launcher and had followed the smoke trail of the grenade as it rose up at the tail of Blackhawk Super 6-1, which was directly overhead. They all heard the thunderclap. The tail boom of the bird cracked in the flash, and its rotor stopped spinning with a horrible grinding sound. followed by a coughing chug, chug, chug. The chopper kept moving forward, but shuddered and started to spin, first slowly, then picking up speed. Chapter 3 Ray Dowdy felt a jolt. Nothing too dramatic, but hard enough to make him bounce in his seat behind the minigun on the left side of Super 6-1. Dowdy had been maintaining and flying in Army choppers for a third of his life. He knew the Black Hawk about as well as anybody in the world, and the hit didn't sound or feel too bad. It was probably an RPG. Ever since they roped in their load of D-boys, the air had been thick with smoke trails. This had been a growing concern. The QRF Black Hawk that had gone down the week before had been hit by an RPG. It had burst into flames on impact. That incident started everybody rethinking the way they'd been doing things, even though the task force's 6 missions had gone without a hitch. Some of the pilots began agitating for more flexibility, but their commanders wanted them to stick with the template. Chief Warrant Officer Cliff Wolcott, the pilot of Super 6-1, was not one to complain about anything. His unflappable cool had earned him the nickname Elvis, that and his dead-on impression of the late rock idol. There was a crude cartoon profile of Presley painted on his cockpit door, with the words Velvet Elvis underneath. He was a popular pilot. It was his Black Hawk and crew that had decided to go on several unauthorized aerial safaris, and after killing and butchering a 200-pound boar, Wolcott helped hide the carcass from the commanders. They went back out and killed about a dozen more to hold a surprise barbecue for the task force. The shooting got so furious on that hunt that one of the snipers put a hole through the Black Hawk's rotor. Wolcott took the heat, which was mild, because the pig roast was a huge hit with the men, who had been eating MREs and cafeteria food for more than a month. Wolcott brought back a 200-pound kudu that he himself bagged from the seat of his Black Hawk. He planned to have the trophy head mounted. Wolcott was the kind of pilot who would complain to his crew chiefs that he wished he could change places with them. "I have to fly the helicopter while you guys in back get to have all the fun." His exploits were legendary. He had flown secret missions hundreds of miles behind enemy lines into Iraq during the Gulf War, refueling in flight to infiltrate troops searching for Saddam Hussein's Scud missile sites. When the grenade hit, Super 6-1 was in a low orbit over the target area, varying speed between 50 and 70 knots, trying to avoid moving over the same streets on every pass. In back were Dowdy and the other crew chief, Staff Sergeant Charlie Warren, and 4 Delta snipers seated on ammo cans. They were busy selecting targets below, the crew chiefs with their miniguns and the snipers with their custom rifles. At first, they shot only at armed Somalis who were moving toward the target area. But as the volume of fire intensified, they'd begun targeting anyone with a weapon. Since many of the armed men stayed in crowds, pretty soon Dowdy was mowing down whole crowds of Sammies. He felt justified. When the QRF's Black Hawk had gone down, Somali mobs had mutilated the corpses of the dead crew chiefs. This being the first mission since then, as a fellow Black Hawk crewman, Dowdy was in full payback mode. Whenever he saw a Somali fall under his guns, he'd scream the name of one of the men killed in the crash, something he had vowed to do. The D-boys in back kept looking up at him, wondering what he was doing. Dowdy wasn't being choosy about his targets. He figured anybody moving toward the fight at that point wasn't bringing flowers. He dropped one Somali with the best shot he'd ever made. One round hit the man in the left buttock, and another splashed into his right upper torso. The man ran, but then stumbled, dropped his gun, and then collapsed in the road. "Nice shot, Ray," said Pilot Wolcott over the intercom. When he was close to using the last of his own ammunition, after expending thousands of rounds, Dowdy reached across to the right side of the aircraft where Warren sat, fishing for one of his partner's ammo cans. "Hey, I got a guy with an RPG," said Warren. "He's 5 o'clock, moving to 6 o'clock." Which meant, since the chopper was in a left-turning orbit, the guy ought to be showing up on Dowdy's side any second. He couldn't spot him. "Is he by a building or something you can describe?" Warren started to answer when they felt the jolt. Dowdy had that second or two of feeling all right about it, but when the chopper started its spin, he knew they were in trouble. He gripped his seat and looked forward to the cockpit. Dowdy knew that the correct emergency procedure for a tail rotor hit was to pull back on the power control levers, taking the engines offline. This eliminated torque, which was what caused the craft to spin counter to the direction of the rotors. He heard Elvis ask his co-pilot, Chief Warrant Officer Donovan Bull Briley, "Hey, Bull, you gonna pull the PCLs offline or what?" Walcott delivered this line in his typically teasing fashion. Briley was already pulling the levers. He yanked them back so hard, the whole aircraft shook. The spin continued. The second turnabout was more violent. This was all happening in seconds, but to Dowdy, it seemed much longer. Elvis made a last radio transmission. 6-1, going down. Dowdy and Warren shouted at the D-boys in back to get down and to hold on. The crew chiefs were on seats that could absorb at least some of the impact, but the snipers were sitting upright in back without protection. The impact could crush their spines. The operators scrambled off the ammo cans and spread-eagled, the better to spread the impact out over their bodies. As the spin accelerated, they reached for something to hold on to. One of them, Sergeant First Class Jim Smith, grabbed hold with one hand to a bar behind Warren's seat, and just then the accelerating spin sent his feet flying out the side door. Smith's shoulder wrenched with pain, but he hung on. Dowdy glanced down and noticed he hadn't fastened his seat belt. The helicopter clipped the top of a house. Then it flipped over hard and slammed into the alley nose first and tilted on its left side. Chapter 4 Nelson watched dumbstruck as the chopper fell. "Oh my God, you guys, look at this!" he shouted. "Look at this!" Waddell gasped, "Oh Jesus!" and fought the urge to just stand and watch the bird go down. He turned away to keep his eyes on his corner. Nelson shouted, "It just went down! It just crashed!" "What happened?" called Lieutenant DiTommaso, who came running. "A bird just went down," Nelson said. "We've got to go! We've got to go right now!" Word spread wildly over the radio, voices overlapping with the bad news. There was no pretense now of the deadpan military cool, that mandatory monotone that conveyed everything under control. Voices rose with surprise and fear. "We got a Black Hawk going down! We've got a Black Hawk going down! We got a Black Hawk crashed in the city! 6-1! He took an RPG! 6-1 down! We got a bird down northeast of the target! I need you to move on out and secure that location!" "Roger. Bird down." There was more than a helicopter crash. It cracked the task force's sense of righteous invulnerability. The Black Hawks and Little Birds were their trump card in this godforsaken place. The choppers, more than their rifles and machine guns, were what kept the savage mobs at a distance. The Somalis couldn't shoot them down. But they had seen it. The choppers spinning, falling, one of the D-boys hanging on with one hand, both feet in the air, riding it down. Chapter 5 Super 6-1 had clipped the roof of Abdiaziz Ali Aden's house as it crashed. Aden was a slip of a teenager, with thick bushy hair and glossy black skin, one of 11 children, 8 of whom still lived in the house about 6 blocks east of the Bukhara market. That Sunday afternoon, most of them were at home, napping or relaxing after a late lunch, staying out of the hot sun. Aden had heard the helicopters coming in low, so low that the big tree that stood in the central courtyard of his stone house was uprooted. Then he heard shooting to the west near Holwadig, the big road that passed before the Olympic Hotel 3 blocks over. He ran toward the noise, crossing Marahan Road outside the door, and then Wadigli Road, keeping to the north walls of the alley. The sky was dark with smoke. As he neared the hotel, the air around him sizzled and cracked with gunfire. Above him were helicopters, some with lines of flame coming from their guns. He ran 2 blocks with his head down, staying against the wall, until he saw American trucks and Humvees, with machine guns mounted on them, shooting everywhere. The Rangers wore body armor and helmets with goggles. Aiden could see no part of them that looked human. They were like futuristic warriors from an American movie. People were running madly, hiding. There was a line of Somali men in handcuffs being loaded onto big trucks. On the street were dead people and a donkey dead on its side, its water cart still attached and upended. It terrified him. As he started back toward his house, one of the Blackhawks flew over him at rooftop level. It made a rackety blast, and wash from its rotors swept over the dirt alley like a violent storm. Through this dust, Aiden saw a Somali militiaman with an RPG tube step into the alley and drop to one knee. The militiaman waited until the helicopter had passed overhead. Then he leaned the tube up and fired at the aircraft from behind. Aiden saw a great flash from the back end of the tube, and then saw the grenade climb and explode into the rear of the helicopter, cracking the tail. It began turning, so close that Aiden could see the pilot inside struggling at the controls. It was tilted slightly toward Aiden when it hit the roof of his house with a loud crunch, and then slammed on its side into the alley with a great scraping crash in a thick cloud of dust. Fearing it had crushed his house and killed his family, he ran back. He found his parents and brothers and sisters trapped under a broad sheet of tin roof. They had stepped outside and had been standing against the west wall when the helicopter hit and the roof came down on them. They were not badly hurt. Aiden worked his way past the huge black body of the crashed helicopter, which had fallen sideways so that the bottom faced him. He helped pull the roof off his family. Afraid that the helicopter would explode, they all ran across Marahan Road, the wide, rutted dirt road just out their front door, to a friend's house 3 doors up. When a few minutes passed with no flames and no explosion, Aiden came back to guard his house. In Mogadishu, if you left your house open and undefended, it would be looted. He entered through the front door and stood in the courtyard by the uprooted tree. The wall that faced the alley where the helicopter had fallen was now just a heap of stones and dusty mortar. Aiden saw an American soldier climb out of the hulk, and then another with an M16. He turned and ran back out the door to a green Volkswagen parked against the wall across the same alley where the helicopter had fallen. He crawled under it, curling himself up into a ball. When the American soldier with the gun rounded the corner, he saw Aiden, peered at him closely, probably looking for a weapon, and then moved on. He stopped near the front end of the car. Aiden could have reached out and touched the soldier's boots, and pointed his gun at a Somali man with an M16 across the wide street. The two men fired at the same time, but neither fell. Then the Somali man's gun jammed, and the American didn't shoot. He ran over to the wall across Marahan Road, closer, and shot him. The bullet went in the Somali man's forehead. Then the American ran over and shot him 3 more times where he lay on the road. As he did this, a big Somali woman came running from a narrow alley beside the house, right in front of the soldier. Startled, he quickly fired his weapon. The woman fell face forward, dropping like a sack, without putting out her arms to break the fall. More Somalis came now with guns, shooting at the American. He dropped to one knee and shot them, many of them, but the Somalis' bullets also hit him. Others came out from hiding then and moved toward the crash. Then a helicopter landed right on Marahan Road, and these Somalis scattered. It seemed impossible that a helicopter could fit in such a small space. It was one of the little ones. The roar of the helicopter was deafening, and dust swirled around. Aidan couldn't breathe. Then the shooting got worse. One of the pilots was leaning out of the helicopter, aiming his weapon south toward the crest of the hill. Another ran from the helicopter toward the one that had crashed. The shooting was even worse then. It was so loud that the sound of the helicopter and the guns was just one ongoing explosion. Bullets hit and rocked the old car. Aidan curled himself up tight and wished he was someplace else. Chapter 6 Cameras on the three observation choppers captured the disaster close up and in color. General Garrison and his staff watched on screens at the JOC. They saw Wolcott's Black Hawk moving smoothly, then a shudder and puff of smoke near the tail rotor, then an awkward counter-rotation as Super 6-1 fell, making two slow turns clockwise, nose up, until its belly hit the top of a stone building and its front end was cast down violently. On impact, its main rotors snapped and went flying. The body of the Black Hawk came to rest in a narrow alley on its side, against a stone wall in a cloud of dust. There wasn't enough time for anyone to consider all the ramifications of that crash. But the sick, sinking feeling that came over officers watching on screen went way beyond the immediate fate of the men on board. They had lost the initiative. The only way to regain it now would be to bolster strength at the crash site, but that would take time and movement, which meant casualties. There were already casualties on the downed bird. There was no time to reflect on causes or consequences. If Elvis's chopper had gone down in flames, the general could just pull everybody out with the prisoners as planned and mount a second mission to retrieve the bodies and make sure the chopper was completely destroyed. There were sensitive items on the bird that the army didn't want just anybody to have. But seeing men climb out of the wreckage and watching as the unscripted battle now joined around it, the ground shifted beneath Garrison's feet. The next moves were part of a contingency they had rehearsed. Another Black Hawk would take Super 6-1's place over the target area, and the CSAR bird would move in and drop its team. Those 15 men would give emergency medical treatment and provide some protection for the crash survivors, but they couldn't hold out long. Already, mobs of Somalis were moving toward the crash site from all directions. Securing it would take all the men on the ground. The mission had been designed for speed, swiftly in, swiftly out. Now they were stuck. The entire force at the target building and on the convoy would have to fight their way to the crash site. They had to move fast before Idid's forces surrounded it and cut it off. If that happened, the crash survivors and the CSAR team would have no hope. Delta Force and the Rangers were the best the Army had to offer. Now they were going to be tested. It was hard to imagine any other force of 150 men trapped in a hostile city, besieged on all sides by a heavily armed populace who had a reasonable chance of surviving. They were at the eye of a terrible storm. The observation birds showed burning tires, sending tall black columns of smoke around the perimeter of the contested blocks. Many thousands of armed Somalis were thronging toward those plumes from all directions, on vehicles and on foot. People were erecting barricades and digging trenches across roads, laying traps for American vehicles, trying to seal them in. The streets surrounding the target house and crash site were already mobbed. You could see the ring closing. Word was sent to the 10th Mountain Division troops across the city to mobilize immediately. This was going to be one hell of a gunfight. Chapter 7 "We gotta go," Nelson told Lieutenant DiTommaso. "We gotta go right now." From Chalk 2's position at the target block's northeast corner, Nelson had gotten a pretty good fix on where Super 6-1 had crashed. He could see crowds of Somalis already running that way. "No, we've got to stay here," said the lieutenant. "There's a crowd over there," argued Nelson, the impending disaster overcoming his deference for rank. "Stand fast," Di Tommaso said. "I'm going," said Nelson. Guns poked out of a window across the street, and just then he spotted two Somali boys running, one with something in his hand. Nelson dropped to a knee and fired a burst with the M60. Both boys fell. One had been holding a stick. The other got up and limped for cover. Specialist Waddell was feeling the same urge to run toward the crash. They had all heard about the way the Somalis had mutilated the remains of the men who died in the previous Black Hawk crash. In the hangar, they had talked it over. They resolved that such a thing would never happen to their guys. Di Tommaso held Nelson back. He raised Captain Steele on the radio. "I know where it is. I'm leaving," the lieutenant said. "No, wait," said Steele. He could understand the urge to go help. But if Chalk 2 just took off, the target building perimeter would break down. He tried to get on the command net, but the airwaves were so busy he couldn't be heard. He waited 15 seconds. "We need to go," Nelson was shouting at Di Tommaso. "Now!" As he started running, Steele called back. "Okay, go," he told Di Tommaso. "But I want somebody to stay." Di Tommaso shouted, "All right, Nelson. Make it happen." With some of the men already in pursuit of Nelson, the lieutenant ran down the street to Sergeant Urich. He would leave half the chalk. "You keep the fight here," he told Urich. 8 rangers moved at a trot. Di Tommaso caught up with Nelson and his M60 in front. Waddell was in the rear with his saw. They moved with their weapons up and ready. Somalis took wild shots at them from windows and doorways as they moved, but no one was hit. Twice on their way east, Nelson dropped to a knee and opened fire on the crowd moving parallel to them 1 block north. When they rounded the corner 3 blocks over, there was a wide sand road that sloped down to the intersection of the alley where Super 6-1 lay. Straight in front of them, and this just astonished Nelson, one of the little birds had landed. Its rotors were turning in a space so small, the tips were just inches from the stone walls. Chapter 8. Piloting the little bird 4-star-1, Chief Warrant Officers Keith Jones and Carl Meyer searched for and found the fallen Black Hawk minutes after it went down. They could tell by the way the front end of the bird had crumpled that Elvis and Bull were probably dead. Jones saw one soldier, Staff Sergeant Daniel Bush, on the ground, propped against a wall, bleeding from the stomach, with several Somalis splayed on the ground around him. Landing in the big intersection near Bush would have been easier, but Jones didn't want to be a fat target from 4 different directions. He eased the bird up the street between 2 stone houses and set it down on a slope. He and Meyer felt themselves rock back when they touched down. As soon as they landed, Sammies came at them. Both pilots opened fire with handguns. Then Sergeant Smith, the operator who had hung on with one hand as the Black Hawk fell, and the second of the 2 soldiers, Abdiaziz Ali Aden, had seen climb out of the wreckage. Bush had been the first, appeared alongside Jones's window. Over the din, he mouthed to Jones, "I need help." His one arm hung limp. Jones hopped out and followed Smith back to the intersection, leaving Meyer to control the bird and provide cover up the alley. Just then, Lieutenant Di Tommaso and his men rounded the corner and came face to face with the little bird. Meyer nearly shot the lieutenant. When the pilot lowered his weapon, the startled Di Tommaso tapped his helmet, indicating he wanted a head count on casualties. Meyer gestured that he didn't know. Nelson and the other rangers hurried down the slope, ducking under the blades of the little bird. Nelson saw Bush leaning against a wall one block down with a bad gut wound. The Delta sniper had his saw on his lap and a .45 pistol on the ground in front of him. There were two Somali bodies nearby. Bush, a devoutly religious man, had told his mother before leaving for Somalia, "A good Christian soldier is just a click away from heaven." Nelson recognized him as the guy who beat all comers in the hangar at Scrabble. One poor guy had lost 41 straight games to him. There was a mass of blood in his lap now. Bush looked ghostly white. Gone. Nelson shot one of the Somalis on the ground, who was still breathing, and then lay behind the bodies for cover. He picked up Bush's .45 handgun and stuck it in his pocket. The hulking frame of the Black Hawk was across the wide road to his right in the alley. Somalis climbing on the wreckage fled when they saw the Rangers round the corner. As the rest of the squad fanned out to form a perimeter, Jones and Smith dragged Bush's limp body toward the Little Bird. Jones helped Smith into the small space behind the cockpit, and then stooped and lifted Bush to the doorway, setting him in Smith's lap. Smith wrapped his arms around the more badly wounded Delta sniper as Jones tried to apply first aid. Bush had been shot just under the steel belly plate of his body armor. His eyes were gray and rolled up in his head. Jones knew there was nothing he could do for him. The pilot stepped out and climbed back into his seat. On the radio, he heard Air Commander Matthews in the C-2 Bird. 4-1, come on out. Come out now. Jones grabbed the stick and told Meyer, "I have it." He told the command net, 4-1 is coming out. Chapter 9. Under the steady drone of his rotors, layered deep in the overlap of urgent calls in his headphones, Chief Warrant Officer Mike Durant had picked out the voice of his friend Cliff. 6-1, going down. Just like that. Elvis's voice was oddly calm, matter of fact. Durant and his co-pilot, Chief Warrant Officer Ray Frank, were circling barren land north of Mogadishu in Super 6-4, a Black Hawk just like the one Elvis had been flying. They had two crew chiefs in back, Staff Sergeant Bill Cleveland and Sergeant Tommy Field, waiting behind silent guns. For years they had done little but prepare rigorously for battle. But here they were, stuck in this calm, oval flight pattern over sand, a good 4-minute flight from the action. The shadow of their chopper glided over the flat, empty landscape. Mogadishu ended abruptly and turned to sand and scrub brush north of October 21st Road. From there to the blazing horizon was little but stubby thorn trees, cactus, goats, and camels in a hazy ocean of sand. Durant thought about his friends, Elvis and Bull. They were skilled veteran warriors. It didn't seem possible that a motley rabble of Somalis had managed to shoot them out of the air. Bull Briley had seen action from Korea to the invasion of Panama. Durant remembered seeing Bull angry the night before. He'd gotten a chance to phone home, the first chance in months, and had gotten the damned answering machine. God, wouldn't it be sad if... Durant continued his methodical turns. Every time he banked west, it felt like he was flying straight into the sun. Going down over Mog was bad news, but not catastrophic. It was a contingency. They had practiced it since their arrival, with Elvis's own helicopter, in fact, which was weird. It wasn't even that shocking, at least not to the pilots, who had a finer sense of the risks they ran than most of the men they flew. Most of the Rangers were practically kids. They had grown up in the most powerful nation on Earth, and saw these techno-laden, state-of-the-art choppers as symbols of America's vast military might, all but invulnerable over a third-world dump like Moog. It was a myth that had survived the downing of the QRF's Black Hawk. That was chalked up as a lucky shot. RPGs were meant for ground fighting. It was difficult and dangerous, almost suicidal, to point one skyward. The violent backblast could kill the shooter, and the grenade would only fly up 1,000 feet or so, with a whoosh and a telltale trail of smoke pointing back to the shooter. So if the backblast didn't get him, one of the quick guns of the little birds surely would. They were all but useless against a fast-moving, low-flying helicopter, so the logic went. And the Black Hawk was damn near indestructible. It could take a hammering without even changing course. It was designed to stay in the air no matter what. So most of the foot soldiers who rode in the birds regarded the downing of a Black Hawk as a one-in-a-million event. Not the pilots. Since that first Black Hawk had gone down, they'd seen more and more of those climbing smoke trails and sudden airbursts. Going down was suddenly notched from possible to probable, and entered their nightmares. Not that it deterred Durant and the other pilots in the least. Taking risks was what they did. The 160th SOAR, the Night Stalkers, chauffeured the most elite soldiers in the U.S. military into some of the most dangerous spots on the planet. Durant was a compact man. He was short, fit, dark-haired, and had this way of standing ramrod straight, feet set slightly wider than his shoulders, as if daring someone to knock him down. If he looked better rested than most of the guys back at the hangar, it was because Durant had searched out a sleeping space in the small cooking area of a trailer behind the JOC. All the pilots slept in the trailers, which were relatively luxurious compared to the cots in the hangar. Given the precision and alertness flying demanded, not to mention the responsibility for their crew and their multi-million-dollar high-tech flying machines, Garrison considered well-rested pilots a priority. Durant had done better than most. The cooking trailer was air-conditioned. His part of the deal was he had to break down his bunk every night and clear the space for the cooks, but it was well worth the hassle. Durant had been with the Night Stalkers long enough to be a veteran of dangerous, low-flying night missions in the Persian Gulf War and the invasion of Panama. He had grown up in Berlin, New Hampshire, with a reputation for being a cut-up and an athlete, a football and hockey player. Age and experience had changed him. Many of the people in his neighborhood in Tennessee, just over the state line from the Night Stalkers' base at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, didn't even know what he did for a living. His own family often didn't know where he was. It was hard to keep track. If Durant wasn't on a real mission like this one, he was off somewhere in the world practicing for one. Practice defined the lives of the Night Stalkers. They practice everything, even crashing. When they were done, they flew off someplace new and practiced it again, again, and again. Their moves in the electronic maze of their cockpits were so well rehearsed they had become instinctive. On the day Durant's unit was dispatched to Somalia, they had gotten only 2 hours' notice, enough time to drive home and spend 15 minutes with his wife, Laurie, and year-old son, Joey. Never mind that his parents were due in town the next day for a long-planned week-long visit, that Joey's first birthday was in 3 days, and Laurie was due to resume school teaching in a week, or that the house they were building was only half-finished, with Durant playing subcontractor. Laurie knew better than to protest. She had just pitched in to help him pack. It wasn't immediately apparent, but Durant was also an emotional man. He fit in with his daring aviation unit, men whose allegiance was as much to action as flag, but the sentiment he felt for his wife and baby son, who had just started to crawl, was closer to the surface than with some of these guys. There were men in his unit who made a show of how hard it was to leave, but who secretly lived for missions and weren't happy unless in danger. Durant wasn't that way. It was hard to leave Laurie and his baby boy, to miss his parents and the birthday party. He had been looking forward to it. He phoned his folks to tell them and to say how sorry he was. He was not allowed to say where he was going. There was no time even to write out a list of the things that needed doing on the new house. He would send that via email from Mogadishu, way overusing his allotted number of bytes in the batch mailing. Durant stood with his travel bag in the doorway of their home, with that stiff posture of his, kissed Laurie goodbye, and went off to war. Even his leavings were well practiced. After Elvis crashed, Durant knew three things would happen quickly. The ground forces would begin moving to the crash site. Super 6-8, the CASR bird, one of the Blackhawks in the holding pattern with Durant, would be summoned to deliver a team of medics and snipers. His bird, Super 6-4, would be asked to fill Elvis's vacant slot, flying a low orbit over the action, providing covering fire. For now, they waited and circled. On a mission like this one, with so many birds in the air, breaking discipline meant becoming a greater hazard than the enemy. For Durant, the most harrowing part of his mission was done. Inserting Chalk 1, his 15-man portion of the ground force, had meant descending into an opaque cloud of dust to rooftop level over the target building, avoiding poles and wires, and squinting down through the Blackhawk's chin bubble into the brown swirl to stay lined up while the men slid down ropes to the ground. All Durant could do was hold blind and steady, and pray that none of the other birds flitting around him in the cloud got thrown off schedule or bumped off course. A complex mission like this one was choreographed as carefully as a ballet, only dangerous as hell. Guys got killed all the time just training for exercises like this, much less ducking RPGs and small arms fire. Durant had inserted Chalk 1 without incident. The rest was supposed to be easy. Now, nothing was going to be easy. Chapter 10 Admiral Jonathan Howe's first inkling that something was amiss in Mogadishu came when air traffic controllers at the UN compound forced his plane to circle out over the ocean for a time before landing. Howe was returning from meetings in Djibouti and Addis Ababa, exploring a plan for bringing Idid peacefully to heel. When they were cleared to land, Howe saw attack helicopters refueling and uploading ammo on the tarmac by the Task Force Ranger hangar. When he landed, Howe telephoned his chief of staff. He was told about the Ranger raid and the downed helicopter. The aide told him there was a big fight going on in the city, and he would probably be stuck for a while at the airport. Howe was a slender, white-haired man whose pale complexion hadn't even pinked after 7 months in Mogadishu. His staff joked that it was from all those years aboard submarines, although in Howe's distinguished naval career, he had commanded his share of surface vessels, everything from battleships to aircraft carriers. Whatever the cause, he seemed immune to sunlight, even Somalia's. Idid's propaganda sheets had dubbed him Animal Howe, but the envoy's calm, polite manner belied the nickname. He had served as Deputy National Security Advisor for President Bush and had helped with the transition in the White House to the Clinton administration, so impressing the new team that he had been talked out of a comfortable Florida retirement to assume the unenviable task of supervising an even trickier transition in Somalia. He was Boutros Ghali's top man in Mog, effectively running the mission on the ground. It was not an easy assignment. Howe had slept for months on a cot in his office on the first floor of the old U.S. Embassy building, which was falling apart. For some of the time, he had a tin-roofed cabin, but regular shellings generally drove him and the other civilians at the compound inside the stone walls of the main building. There were no toilets in the embassy, and so few portable ones outside that the men toted plastic bottles to relieve themselves. They ate three meals a day out of a cafeteria on the grounds. A story in the Washington Post that suggested the UN staff enjoyed luxurious accommodations had provoked bitter laughter. More than anyone, Howe had been responsible for bringing the Rangers to Mogadishu. He had pushed his friends in the White House and Pentagon so hard that summer for a force to snag ID'd that in Washington they were calling him Jonathan Ahab. He was convinced that getting rid of the warlord, not killing him, but arresting him and trying him as a war criminal, would cut through the tangle of tribal hatred that sustained war, anarchy, and famine. The state of the city had shocked him when he arrived 8 months earlier. It was a savage place. Everything had been shot up. Nothing worked. Everything of value had been looted, and nobody was in charge. Here was a country not just at ground zero, but below zero. The very means of recovery had been destroyed. The hobbled predicament of the place was reflected in the number of landmine victims, men, women, and children pulling themselves around on crutches. The UN intervention had ended the famine, but where would Somalia go from there? Efforts to build a coalition government out of the nation's feuding clans were still far from successful. 9 out of 10 Somalis were unemployed, and most of those who did work were employed by the UN and the United States. The factional fighting had gone beyond anything rational or even understandable from the admiral's perspective. He felt contempt for the men responsible, for men like Idid, Ali Mahdi, and the other warlords, the very leaders needed to set Somalia back on its feet. It soon became clear to Howe that power-sharing was not in the plans of Idid and his Somalia National Alliance, SNA, the political-military arm of the Habargidiyya. Having been the principal engine of Barre's defeat 2 years earlier, Idid and his clan felt it was their turn to rule. They had purchased that right with blood, the ancient currency of power. Ali Mahdi and all the other lesser faction leaders were enthusiastic about nation-building plans. Why wouldn't they be? The UN was offering them a share of power they could never wrest from Idid on their own. With the 38,000-strong military force of UNITAF, Unified Task Force, in the country, the backbone being U.S. Marines and the Army's 10th Mountain Division, the warlords had stopped fighting. But when the last of the Marines pulled out on May 4th, and the 10th was relegated to backup duties as the QRF, the situation predictably deteriorated. The worst incident had been the June 5th slaughter of 24 Pakistanis. The next day, the UN had pronounced the SNA an outlaw faction. Idid was officially dealt out of the nation-building process. Over the next few weeks, Howe had authorized a $25,000 bounty for the warlord as gunships flattened Idid's radio Mogadishu and UN troops invaded the warlord's residential compound. To no avail. The Habargidiyya was insulted by the paltry sum being offered for its leader. They countered with a defiant $1 million reward for the capture of Animal Howe. Radio Mogadishu continued broadcasting its propaganda with mobile antennae, and the wily old general just melted into his city. Idid had kept up the pressure. From his southern stronghold, mortar rounds were lobbed daily into UN compounds. Somali employees of the UN mission were terrorized and executed. The warlord proved to be a formidable adversary. His name, Idid, meant one who tolerates no insult. He had been schooled in Italy and the old Soviet Union, and had served as Army Chief of Staff and then Ambassador to India for Siad Barre, before turning on the dictator and routing him. Idid was a slender, fragile-looking man with Semitic features, a bald head and small black eyes. He could be charming, but was also ruthless. Howe believed Idid had two distinct personalities. One day he was all smiles, a warm, engaging, modern, educated man, fluent in several languages, with an open mind and a sense of humor. Idid had 14 children who lived in America. One, a son named Hussein, was a Marine reservist who had come to Somalia with UNITAF forces in the December intervention. It was this cosmopolitan side of Ideed that had encouraged earlier hopes for success. But the next day, without apparent reason, Ideed's black eyes would show nothing but hatred. There were times when even his closest aides avoided him. This was Ideed, the son of a Somali camel herder, who had risen to success as a clever and ruthless killer. He thought nothing of ordering people killed, even his own people. How?